Hi, I'm Susan Swain, host of C-SPAN's Q&A, where we spend an hour with nonfiction writers and historians who add context to today's news. Journalist Rika Sharma Rani discusses her profile of Vice President Kamala Harris's late mother, Sharmila Gopalan, who came to the United States from India in 1958. Following that, Professor Devesh Kapoor, Director of Asia Programs at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, discusses the larger story of Indian immigration to the United States over the last 50 years. Our conversation will begin in just a moment.
We are so grateful to Joe and Jill for welcoming our family into theirs on this incredible journey. And to the woman most responsible for my presence here today, my mother, Sharmila Gopalan Harris, who is always in our hearts. When she came here from India at the age of 19, she maybe didn't quite imagine this moment, but she believed so deeply in an America where a moment like this is possible.
Journalist Rika Sharma Rani, Vice President Harris often credited her mother, who passed away in 2009, for her success. Describe her mother, Sharmila Gopalan, in a nutshell.
Sharmila Gopalan was, based on the descriptions I've seen, was a woman who was small in stature, but fierce in nature. She was very strong. She was very determined. She didn't worry too much about what other people thought of her. And she was a pioneer in many rights. Her story is often told as sort of this, an immigrant story, which it absolutely is, a remarkable story of immigration and her creating opportunity for herself and her family. But even within the sort of narrative of Indian immigration, her story is very unique. It's distinct from even Indian immigrants who, the vast majority of Indian immigrants who came after her. She was a pioneer in her own right.
We will learn more through our conversation about that, but what are you thinking of when you say hers was unique?
She came to the U.S. in 1958. So 7 years before the Immigration Act passed in 1965. So she preceded the wave of immigration from India to the U.S. By several years. And based on my reporting, that seems to have mattered in terms of the trajectory of her life and her story. So, for example, she was actively involved in the civil rights movement in a way that Indian immigrants were not. There were relatively few Indian immigrants in the U.S. at that sort of height of civil rights activism. So most Indian immigrants did not have that experience the way that Sharmila Gopalan did. And I think that mattered. You don't see that sort of activism among Indian immigrants who came after her. And the people that I have spoke to have sort of talked about after 1965, the immigrants that came from India were really trying to assimilate into society. They were trying to make it against great odds in many cases. But there was not this sense of solidarity with the civil rights movement, with Black Americans, that Sharmila Gopalan really exhibited during her time here, her early years here.
What was her professional area of expertise?
She studied endocrinology at UC Berkeley. Before that, she had been studying something called home science in India, which was really a field of study. It's evolved over the years, but at the time was really meant to groom women for domesticity. And she decided that she wanted to study nutrition and endocrinology. She applied to a program at UC Berkeley, and she was accepted. And her family let her go, and that wasn't a given at that time. Women were usually around her age, slated to be married. And so the fact that her parents let her travel this distance to the United States was pretty remarkable.
So I want to dig into that a little bit more. But before I do, in the ways that you have described her, and you've also profiled the vice president,
What can you see as a direct impact of being brought up by this mother in the person that Kamala Harris became?
So there's a few things that I see in Vice President Harris that I think you can see sort of the legacy of her mother. One is just the strength, the sort of belief that she can really do anything. So Vice President's ascension to the vice presidency sort of has echoes of her mother's just fierce will to come to a country she had never been to before. She didn't know anyone. She was a stranger, but it didn't deter her. And so you sort of see that in Vice President Harris's career trajectory and the sort of barrier-breaking nature of some of the positions that she's held. So that's sort of one thing. I think another is a tendency to not put too much stock into how other people are defining her. This is something that Vice President Harris has talked about in various ways throughout her life. This sense that, you know, I know who I am. You might not know who I am, but I know who I am. And you know, if you have to figure that out, great, but I'm cool with it. My impression is that is directly something that came from her mother. It's something that her mother, before her passing in 2009, had said in interviews. You know, she had said, I always taught my girls to define themselves. Don't let anyone else define you. That seems to be a really clear sort of heritage that Vice President Harris got from her mother.
So let's spend a little more time on her early life. When and where was Shyamala Gopalan born?
She was born in Chennai, formerly Madras, in southern India. But her family moved around a little bit, and she spent the bulk of her childhood in Delhi.
And what year was she born? Was it 1939? Is that right?
I believe so, yeah.
The Gopalans were Brahmins in India's caste system. So in the 1940s and 50s, when Shyamala Gopalan would have been a young person in that culture, what did that mean?
Yeah, it's a really good point. I think in understanding her story, that her caste and her sort of position in society, in Indian society as a high caste Brahmin, can't be understated. That certainly facilitated everything that came after. Her father was a high-ranking bureaucrat in India. He was a civil servant. There have been some descriptions of him as a diplomat. That, from my understanding, was not the case. He was a high-ranking bureaucrat. He was involved in sort of the resettlement of refugees from Bangladesh. He spent some time in Africa. So Shyamala sort of grew up in a family that was very sort of educated, connected, outwardly focused, sort of had a knowledge and an understanding of the world outside of India. So that certainly played a role in their decision to let Shyamala come to the United States.
What should we know about Shyamala's mother?
The reason I was interested in sort of the reporting I've done on Shyamala Gopalan is because as a person of Indian origin myself, it was very clear to me that her story was very different. I think the most sort of remarkable thing to me was her involvement in the civil rights movement. That's not something, as I mentioned before, that you had really seen. This was a woman who really charted her own path. There was no prototype or model that she was following. She was really finding her way in the world. And I think that took a lot of bravery at that time. She faced a fair bit of discrimination from her own sort of descriptions and things that Vice President Harris has written. So she was a pretty bold woman. I would say, you know, a feminist in some ways. I don't know if she would describe herself that way, but certainly she was sort of, you know, the first, one of the few women of color in her workplace, in her early career.
But these are things that she would not have learned from her mother, because her mother didn't live that kind of life in India. Is that correct?
Sorry, that Vice President Harris would not have learned from?
No, Shyamala's mother, GV's spouse, yeah. Kamala Harris's grandmother is the question.
So Vice President Harris has described her grandmother as somebody who did not have a high school education, but who was very active in her community and was a leader somewhat in her community. I think she has said that she would go out into the villages and distribute and talk about birth control and contraception. And her grandfather would say, you know, like, your mother is going to, you know, get me out of a job. He would joke. So while her mother was not, Shyamala's mother was not educated in the conventional sense, the descriptions of her are really that she was quite progressive, very active in the community, and sort of a leader in her community.
Sure. What I was trying to explore is where these attributes to become a pioneering immigrant to the United States came from. Mm-hmm. And it sounds as in the seeds of progressivism on her mother's part is one answer to that question.
And another answer is progressivism on her father's part. In Indian families, especially back then, it's really the father who would make the decision as to whether, you know, their 19-year-old daughter is going to travel thousands of miles away to go and study. My sense is that Shyamala's father had been was very progressive in his beliefs, in a way that I think was unusual at the time. And again, this all has ties in with sort of being a high-ranking Indian bureaucrat, having sort of a more expansive view of the world.
When Shyamala Gopalan arrived at Berkeley to pursue her graduate studies, what was that campus like at the time?
It really was a hotbed of activism. Civil rights movement was really nearing its height. UC Berkeley was at the center of it. There was the free speech movement that happened around that time. There was a movement on campus to lift up African American academics and writers. So Shyamala was part of a group of students who would get together off campus in the evenings and discuss James Baldwin and Ralph Ellison. And it was a time that was a very, you know, when you think about Berkeley, I think the images that that evokes for a lot of people is really this time, this moment in Berkeley, when campus life was really dynamic and rich, and the Vietnam War was happening and students were protesting the war. So there was a lot going on the UC Berkeley campus at the time that Shyamala Gopalan arrived.
She joined a group, the Berkeley's Afro-American Association, which had an important role in the Black Power movement in the United States and its development. Can you talk about her interest in joining that and the group's acceptance of her as someone with different roots?
Yeah. This was really fascinating, and I spoke with some former students at UC Berkeley who were in this Afro-American Association with her, and she was the only non-Black member. And when I asked about this, one of her sort of lifelong friends, Aubrey LaBrie, who Vice President Harris refers to as Uncle Aubrey, said that it wasn't really a question whether or not they would let her join. There was no discussion. There was no sort of formal meeting to say, will we allow her to join? It was meant to be an association for Black students. I think she just sort of melted into that group and really developed very strong relationships with the students in that group. I also think that there was a broader sort of socio-political context that was happening. At that time, the Black power movement was seen as connected to the broader movement against colonialism. India had been a colony of the British, had gotten its independence in 1947. This was, 10 years later. But there really was this connection in people's minds between the global anti-colonial struggle and the civil rights movement in the US. So, Martin Luther King Jr. had talked about taking inspiration from Mahatma Gandhi. So they weren't seen as, I think they were seen as part and parcel of the same fight.
At those civil rights organizational events and protests is where Shyamala met Donald Harris and ultimately married him in 1963. He is still alive. He's still a professor emeritus at Stanford. What can you tell us about his influence on the family?
So I think that, so we know less about Donald Harris. Shyamala and Donald Harris divorced when Vice President Harris was around 7 years old. They would see him on weekends. They would go visit during the summer. For a time, Shyamala and her two daughters, Kamala and Maya, had moved to Montreal and so were a fair distance from their father. I would say, his influence really ties to her parents' activism, their belief sort of in social justice. I think, like Shyamala, Donald was very much involved in the Afro-American Association. In fact, he was, I believe, a member before her. He would give talks off campus about civil rights. And so certainly that, I think, has carried over into his daughter, just as it has from her mother. Their relationship now, there has been, some apparent tensions. I mean, I won't presume to know what their relationship is now. There was a moment during the campaign where Vice President Harris had made a joke, making light of the stereotype, the Jamaican stereotype of, smoking weed. And her father had taken exception to that publicly. So I think whatever his influence was, would have been sort of earlier on in her life. I think that Vice President Harris was very much raised by her mother.
So Dr. Harris, Shyamala, Dr. Harris, raised their two daughters as a single mom for the rest of her life. And they began regular trips back to India. On her social media page, Vice President Harris talked about her trips to India and her relationship with her grandfather. I wanted to show some of that video.
My grandparents were phenomenal. We would go back to India like every other year. My grandfather fought for and was a defender of the freedom of India. When I was a young girl, being the eldest grandchild, my grandfather would take me on his morning walk. All of his buddies, who also were great leaders, and they would talk about the importance of fighting for a democracy and the importance of fighting for civil rights and that people would be treated equally regardless of where they were born or the circumstances of their birth. Those walks along the beach in India really planted something in my mind and created a commitment in me. Before I even realized it, it has led me to where I am today.
So returning to India on a regular basis, sometime in Montreal with her mother, and then the strong influence in the Berkeley Black community, what did you learn about the cultural influences that Shyamala Harris really intended to imbue in her two daughters?
Mm-hmm. I think this idea of not letting people define you and not fitting neatly into boxes. I think this is where it comes from. Vice President Harris had, as you listed out, sort of an array of cultural influences. And, you know, throughout her life, her mother was very much immersed in Indian culture. Her mother had been sort of a classical Indian singer when she was, had been younger and growing up in India, and she would sing Indian songs and make Indian food. And as the clip just showed, the family would travel to India. At the same time, Shyamala's people in Berkeley were African-Americans. They were people who had been deeply involved in the civil rights struggle. Those were her sort of, you know, her adopted family. So there's this sort of duality. I think there's, you know, this tendency always to sort of say, well, what is she more of? Or, you know, like we want a formula of is Vice President Harris, like, is she really Indian? And I think that a big part of her mother's influence is rejecting that entirely. I think that really comes from not feeling the need to sort of to choose. But I will say that I think that, you know, my impression is that Vice President Harris identifies as a Black woman. I think she respects her Indian culture and certainly has that heritage. But I think, you know, her upbringing was very much immersed in this community, and I think that's how she identifies.
Do you have a story in the reporting that you've done on the vice president, her campaigning, her relationship with her mother and her family? Do you have a particular story that really stands out for you and resonates as an example of the journalism you've done on their lives?
Yeah, I mean, her mother was, I think, really just the jet engine on Kamala Harris's back from very early on. So in her earliest campaigns, her mother was right there with her, holding the signs, you know, passing out flyers and campaigning. And I think that just really epitomizes their relationship. Vice President Harris holds her mother up alongside her heroes, like Shirley Chisholm, Fannie Lou Hamer. Her mother is right up there with them. And I think those early campaigns, when her mother is, you know, marching along beside her, putting up signs and handing out flyers, I think really encapsulates that. So that's something that I think reflects their relationship. There's an earlier story from when they were in Montreal. Vice President Harris had wanted to play soccer on the lawn outside of the building that they lived in at the time. And so to fight for the right to play soccer on the lawn, she launched a protest along with her sister Maya. And so you see sort of glimpses of her mother's activism. You know, her mother protested in the civil rights movement. She would bring Kamala along with her in those protests. I think that, you know, you sort of see that in that story about soccer on the lawn. She wasn't going to sort of tolerate being told no. She was going to fight for what she believed in. So I think that is Shyamala's legacy when we think about Kamala.
You've talked about identifying, the vice president identifying as a Black woman, but of course her Asian Indian roots are very much a part of her story as well. And I'm wondering, as you traveled the United States to report on her and her campaign, what's been the reaction of the Indian American community to her success?
So it's been interesting. I think her selection as Joe Biden's running mate was celebrated and hailed. And certainly when Joe Biden won the election and Kamala Harris became the first Asian and Black woman to ascend to the vice presidency, that has been a huge source of pride for Indian Americans everywhere in the U.S. and in India. You saw a more tempered reaction when Vice President Harris was running her own campaign for president. So in the days of her campaign, I had done some reporting to sort of explore the reaction among Indian Americans. And while Indian Americans were glad that she was in the race and proud to see her there and proud to see more representation of Indian Americans and Asians in sort of the political landscape, they weren't rallying to her campaign in a lot of ways. There certainly was a generational difference. So a lot of older Indian Americans really were sort of very excited about her candidacy. A lot of younger Indian Americans told me that they were excited and glad to see her there, but that wasn't going to factor in significantly into their choice for who they wanted to be the candidate. So early on, I think the reaction was a little bit more tempered. I think as she was selected as vice president, as the vice presidential candidate, and now has become the vice president, I think you have just seen that swell of pride grow. There are some nuances to that, though. Vice President Harris has in the past signaled some sort of criticisms of the Modi government in India. And that is a source of concern for some Indian Americans who are very strong supporters of the Indian president, or prime minister, I should say. And so there's a little bit of a mixed reaction. I would say that's sort of a smaller contingent of folks, but there is definitely sort of a brewing narrative both in India and in the U.S. about, you know, what her positions will be when it comes to, America's relationship with India.
Well, we are out of time. I want to thank you for helping to tell Vice President Harris's family story, her grandparents in India and her mother's emigration to the United States and the life that they lived here. I would invite people who are interested to find more detail in your stories easily searchable online. And thanks again for giving us your time.
Thank you.
We're using Vice President Kamala Harris's family story as a jumping-off point to learn more about America's Indian population, now the second-largest immigration group in the United States.
Connecting our two nations is also a unique and dynamic bridge of 3 million Indian Americans. Today, they are among your best CEOs, academics, astronauts, scientists, economists, doctors, even spelling bee champions. They are your strength. They are also the pride of India.
Dr. Devesh Kapoor directs the Asian programs at Johns Hopkins University. Dr. Kapoor, that was 2016 when Prime Minister Modi addressed the joint session of Congress citing 3 million Indian Americans. What is the number today in 2021?
Well, we don't have the 2018 American Community Survey, which is from the U.S. Census Bureau. The number was 4.2 million.
4.2 million. And we learned in our first segment that when the vice president's mother, Shyamala Gopaland, emigrated to the United States, there were only 12,000 Indian Americans in the country. Actually, they were Indian students studying in graduate schools for the most part. 12,000 to nearly 4 million. What has been the biggest driver of that change?
Well, the biggest driver really was the in 1965 reform of the Immigration Act, which opened up immigration in the U.S. to people from non-white countries. But even then, the the Indian American population in 1980 was about 360,000. It grew to about 1.7 million in 2000 and to about 4.2 million in 2018. So two out of three of all Indian Americans have come to the United States after 2000.
What happened to U.S. immigration law in 1965? What had it been, and what was the big change that had this impact?
Well, so, you know, after, in basically almost exactly 100 years ago, because of the backlash to immigration that emerged around the time of World War I, 1917-1918, the U.S. began to close its borders to immigration. And between 1920 and 1965, and especially through World War II, there was a very sharp drop in immigration relative to what it had been in the late 19th and early 20th century, when we had the big upsurge of immigration, especially from Southern Europe and from Eastern Europe. But immigration, and not just in the US, it was true in Canada and Australia, they all had policies that essentially disallowed immigration from most Asian countries and from Africa and so on. That changed in the United States in 1965, where the race part of the proscription on immigration was taken out. And, you know, it's interesting that it occurred, in fact, these are correlated. It occurred in parallel with the internal reforms in the U.S., on African Americans, allowing them to vote. So these two were parts of huge changes in the United States in the mid-1960s.
Kamala Harris's family went from the mother as an immigrant to the vice presidency in one generation. In your study of Indian Americans, it's a real story of achievement that's not uncommon in a single generation. Here's some of the stats from the book that you published, The Other 1%, that 61% of Asian Americans have bachelor's degree or higher, compared to just one-third of the overall U.S. population. Indian Americans now have the highest household income in the United States, surpassing all other ethnic groups, including white households. And they have the highest propensity of all immigrant groups to live in married family households. Are these three statistics all importantly intertwined to contribute to Indian American success?
Partly, yes. And I think to understand that, I think what our book was basically trying to say, look, this is nothing about this is about intrinsically being Indian. Because if Indians were so good, then India would have been a much more successful country, and Indians wouldn't want to leave India sort of in the first place. So our story in the book is, and this is a core part of all immigration work, which is the very select nature of immigration from India, like to the US. It has been one of the most selective immigrations to the United States, or for that matter, to any country for the past 100 years. The first wave, which comes basically from about 1965 to the late 70s, these are almost all coming from India's most selective institutions, especially doctors and engineers. From the late 70s to about the mid 90s, you get the second wave, which is about largely it's family reunification. And generally, if that trend had continued, the selectivity would have gradually declined, and you wouldn't have seen these numbers the way you see them now. But then something else happened, and that was the tech boom in the US, which created a huge demand for H-1B visas. Now, the H-1B visa you only get if you already have a graduate degree, and your salary, even before you come to the U.S., that salary must be more, essentially, than the median American's salary. So the story we had was, you know, if you look at, say, the great waves of immigration 100 years ago, say, Ireland and Italy, you know, the immigrants come in and basically they climb the stairs sort of above and gradually move upwards. Second generation goes to the first floor, the next generation to the second floor, and so on. But Indians essentially came and took the elevator because they entered a tech boom, and the tech boom itself expanded their opportunities. And so they rose much faster. So they came with higher skills and they entered a sector which boomed much more. And that is a big part of why they did so well.
At the same time, something had to be happening in Indian universities to produce this caliber of talent. What happened at that end of the pipeline?
So I think that's a very good question, that the supply side also changed. Till about the mid-80s, most higher education in India was through public institutions. And then it gradually opened up to the private sector, and a massive number of private sector colleges, especially in engineering, opened up. And as you would imagine, there was the good, the bad, and the ugly. Most were very mediocre. But the sheer number was so large that, you know, the top 10% was large enough to be able to supply this large supply of engineers. The other thing was, unlike China, India was doing poorly in manufacturing. So the Indian engineers were moving much more into services, and the demand for engineers in the U.S. was not in the manufacturing sector, but in the services sector. So both sort of worked out, and it was just fortuitous.
Before we spend more time on the largely successful population, your statistics also suggest that almost 7% of Indian Americans also live below the federal poverty line. Tell me
right.
more about that segment of the population.
So this is a group, you know, look, all groups will have a distribution of education and income. Our work suggests that the fraction of the Indian American population below the poverty line is roughly half that of the general U.S. population. Now, I think one group in this that we think is an important, but by no means the sole part, is undocumented migrants. We know that undocumented workers obviously find it more difficult to get jobs. They find it more difficult to avail of the government benefits that are directed, like, towards the poor. As we know, that data on undocumented migrants is always hard, at least very exactly data. But there seems to be reasonable evidence from a variety of sources that there has been a considerable increase in undocumented immigrants from India, especially in the last, 15 years. Now, these are not really people who are coming, say, from the southern border. They're people who come to the U.S. on legal visas, and their visas sort of expire, and they stay on, and hence they become undocumented.
Have you been able to follow this particular group this year with COVID to find out what their fate has been with the coronavirus?
So we haven't. We did a report last fall where we looked at which sectors of the economy they were. We know that with COVID in the U.S., some sectors have been particularly hard hit. The hospitality sector is a very good example. There are quite a few, you know, relatively low-income Indians who, say, operate taxi cabs, who have restaurants, and so on. And these sectors have been hit particularly hard. Those who work, there are many Indian Americans who work sort of in the, they own and they work sort of in the motel industry, which has also been hit very hard. So we think that these groups or Indian Americans working in these sectors will be hit particularly hard. And so we expect both in the US population at large and among Indian Americans, poverty levels like to rise.
Looking across the Indian American group, is it homogenous? Are certain classes or castes from India disproportionately represented among those who immigrate to the United States?
So, you know, as you know, Susan, I mean, India is a very heterogeneous society, you know, languages, religions. And one thing that is somewhat, you know, sui generis to India is caste. So in my prior work on this, which came out in 2010, you know, it was clear that overwhelming majority were upper caste. Not surprising, because the selection to come into the U.S. From India to the U.S. is largely driven by education. Upper castes had much greater access to higher education, and therefore they were much more able to come, like, to the U.S. Access to higher education has broadened considerably, especially in the last 15 years or so. So we are beginning to see what we call more middle castes, and now even from the lower castes, people coming to the U.S. But I think even now, the by far upper castes are much more represented in the Indian American population relative to their share in the Indian population.
Networking is always an important thing among immigrant groups. When Indian Americans come to the United States and network to find employment, is there any class discrimination or caste discrimination among the groups here, or are all seen as fellow immigrants from native land and welcomed equally?
Susan, do you mean sort of among Indian Americans?
Yes.
Or by other Americans?
I mean Indian Americans treating one another equally when they come to the country. In other words, do the caste distinctions in India, are they pervasive when these groups come to the United States?
So, you know, this is the survey which we've done in September. We have a whole set of questions on this, which we are looking at. So if you begin with the networking, so the networking actually occurs a lot along regional lines and somewhat on religious lines. So the state of Andhra Pradesh, whose native language is Telugu, so there are Telugu networks which are organized around linguistic lines and cultural lines, right? Because they share certain culture. So there are these cultural things between Punjabis, between Tamilians, Marathis, Bengalis, that are organized around festivals, around cuisine, around language, around regional cinema, and so on and so forth. So there is that part. Then there are professional networking groups that work, that are more you know, Indian American or even embedded in larger South Asian American groups, and sometimes among Asian American groups. You know, you have lawyer associations, you have ones on financing new ventures, and so on and so forth. Now, caste is actually, in terms of groups organizing around caste, we see very little evidence of that. Now, that doesn't mean that there isn't things like marriage that might occur through caste. And we hear stories of caste discrimination. And, you know, as you know, there's a case going on with, you know, Cisco, or filed by some people. But What we don't know is how extensive it is. Now, we do know is that the fraction of the Indian American population that comes from the lowest caste Dalits, that is very small, meaning it's at most a couple of percentage points. So relative to the share in the Indian population, which is about 18%. So that's what our survey is trying to understand, and we should have more robust findings. We want to be very careful in analyzing this you know, data, but I think by end of April, we should have a good handle on this.
You've studied the top five states that Indians emigrate to in the United States, and they are in order: California, Texas, New York, New Jersey, and Illinois. I wanted to talk a little bit about how this population is influencing politics. Let's start with party affiliation. There are certainly some well-known Republican politicians, for example, former Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal, former South Carolina and UN Ambassador Nikki Haley, Ajit Pai, former FCC chair. But Indians, you say, vote overwhelmingly Democratic. Why is that?
So, I think the simplest answer is that, the Democratic Party is more open to immigrants than the Republican Party. This wasn't, as you know, always the case. You know, when George Bush was the president, you did see a possibility of more Indian Americans moving towards the Republican Party. Because they have many features that were part of the Republican Party agenda. Here, I want to stress the old Republican Party, because what it is now is a caricature of its former self. But that was, you know, Indian Americans were entrepreneurs like less regulation, which is what the Republican Party wants. You know, they want lower taxes, they are wealthier, again, they are socially more conservative, again, the family value thing of the Republican Party. All of these would have nudged or slowly taken, I think, more Indians towards the Republican Party. But I think two things happen. One is, since most Indian Americans are not Christian, the influence or the overt influence of evangelicals in the Republican Party have made them quite wary. And second, and this particularly has happened in the last, 5-7 years, is the very strong anti-immigrant sentiment in among parts of the Republican Party. And it's not just Indian Americans, all other, you know, immigrant groups have, of course, also been more wary of the Republican Party as a result.
What's been the trend toward Indian Americans seeking public office in recent years?
So that's been increasing considerably. As you know, in general, the first generation is somewhat disengaged from politics, at least in taking part directly. So the first generation, however, you know, many have become big entrepreneurs, CEOs, etc., and have acquired considerable wealth. Their involvement in American politics has been more through financial support of candidates, parties, and so on. The second generation, those who are born here, they are more engaged in direct participation as candidates. One thing, for instance, we noticed, the first generation, very few were trained in law, because, you know, when you come to the U.S., having a law degree from India does not matter. But having a medical degree or an engineering degree, it's much easier to participate. Or that degree, you can practice your occupation much more easily. But the second generation is where we see many more Indian Americans doing law degrees. And as you know, law is often a pathway to, participate, or it's an easier pathway to get into politics. And that's what we tend to see.
We have about 5 minutes left. I have a few more questions for you. With this increase in population, you report that 150,000 Asian Indians will become eligible to vote each year on top of the existing voting population. Is it beginning to change party politics in any states?
So, in some ways, if you look at the top states like California and New York, or Illinois, you know, these are Democratic states. They are pretty blue states. And if you're a blue voter in a blue state, your marginal impact is lower, right? You're not a swing voter in a swing state like, say, Cuban Americans in Florida. I think where it'll be interesting is, especially in close elections, is in states that are purple and might be becoming more blue, and that, you know, Georgia and Texas and Florida, Florida is still, you know, fairly red. But these are the states where you see more immigration of Indian Americans, more Indian American immigrants moving to, and I see more of an effect in those states.
Of course, at this point, we're all interested in the coronavirus mitigation and the economy. But in addition to those, are there any current policy debates that are of particular interest to the Indian American community?
I think immigration for sure. You know, so as I said earlier, the big pathway for Indians to come to the United States was the H-1B visa. Today, for instance, to getting a green card, there are these country quotas. You know, it's a 7% for any specific nationality. Given the large number of Indian immigrants, they have now the longest waits. It can go up to 10 years in some cases, 50 years, which of course means that families then get fed up and they move back, or they move to Canada or, you know, other countries, which is a big loss to the US given their skills and so on. So I think one thing they're very interested in is, and the Biden campaign had promised to do away with country quotas, and that would really be that would be something that would be very welcomed among Indian Americans.
So turning to India, how did India in particular and South Asian countries in general react to Vice President Kamala Harris's success?
Well, you know, Kamala Harris, you know, if you see the stories or pictures in Tamil Nadu, in the village where her family ancestry is from, you know, they were overjoyed. In India, you know, at a people level, there is obvious pride. Now, the Modi government had really been, you know, it managed, compared to most other countries, it managed a pretty reasonable relationship with the Trump administration. And you saw that when in September 2019, you know, there was this huge event in Houston, and Trump came for Modi's speech and so on. Now, the Democrats are more liberal, and, you know, there are concerns in the Indian government that, that the record of the Modi government will come under much greater scrutiny. There'll be more pressures, some of it led by Indian American legislators like Kamala Harris, Pramila Jayapal, the congresswoman from Seattle, from Ro Khanna, who's a congressman from California, and so on. But I think there is a general sense also that, given given the pressures on the US-China relationship, perhaps the degree of pressure by the Biden administration on the Indian government might be somewhat less.
One of Vice President Harris's nieces, Meena Harris, has been using her Twitter account to get involved and comment on Indian politics. How is that being received?
Badly.
Why?
I mean, it's a fairly narcissistic, you know, she has no idea what she's talking about. And, you know, it's so easy to tweet things about these things. And, you know, it hardly helps her aunt. I would have thought she would be more aware of the consequences of just, you know, easy, facile tweets when her, you know, which puts her aunt in a somewhat awkward position.
So, Dr. Kapoor, as we close here, if you were to write a headline on the story of the last 50 years of Indian immigration to the United States, what would it be?
I think the headline would be the possibilities that the United States has. I mean, there is no, Indian immigrants have done well in many countries, but their degree of success in the United States is really quite exceptional. And I think it speaks a lot to a certain openness in the United States, which is pretty uncommon around the world. And I think that would be my headline, to look at this positive aspect, despite all the noise, you know, all the things that have been happening in the past few years. I do think this is a symbolic of that possibility.
Dr. Kapoor, thank you so much for giving us an overview on Indian immigration and the success of the Indian community in the United States. If people are interested, your book is still available. It's called The Other 1%. And you can find his work at Johns Hopkins University in the Asian Programs Department. Thank you so much for your time.
Susan, just to add, that book was with two co-authors. I want to just thank them, Sanjoy Chakravarty of Temple University and Professor Nirvikar Singh of UC Santa Cruz.
I'm sure they will be happy for the mention. Thank you for doing that. And thanks again for being with us for this interview.
Thank you again. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to C-SPAN's Q&A. And subscribe to us wherever you get your podcast so you'll never miss an episode. And while you're there, please take a minute to rate and review us. You can also send us an email about Q&A at podcasts@c-span.org. Send me your questions, your comments, or ideas. Your feedback is welcome.